Welcome, everyone, to our final session with Dr. Elaine Franz of Kent State University. This has been a wonderful series, and we're concluding with the social gospel of labor. And I want to tell you about the next series that's coming up beginning March 1st will be our Lenten series. And for the first session only, Graham Standish is coming to talk about becoming a grounded soul. You probably remember him. He's done a number of seminars before, and he's preached at Westminster. He's the executive director of Samaritan Counseling. So I think this will be an excellent session. And then the next 3 weeks, we'll have a new person, Donna Giver Johnston from the seminary. So we'll talk more about that next week. And now I'll turn it over to Elaine.
Thank you, Sarah. And hello, everybody. Sorry, apologies that I have my mask, but I've had some sort of horrific plague for the last week. And I got better yesterday and I was like, I can come in, but I want to wear a mask just in case there's anything remaining of it. So I'm glad I could be here. I was getting a little nervous. As things were falling off my calendar, I'm like, oh no, but this was the first thing that was able to stay. So today I want to talk about the social gospel movement as it related to labor, and particularly sort of how the consequences of the 1877 strike that we talked about last week ended up leading to a negotiation between Christianity and the labor movement. And that really ended up being very important. Okay, so after 1877 and the sort of national trauma of 1877, and I guess we talked about before it too, in some sense, there was a sense of anger among some workers that churches seemed to have chosen a side, and that side was the side of capital, right? And I think I left last week with a Henry Ward Beecher quote, you know, that he was, and he's trying to dial it back, you know, that was not very sympathetic to labor at all. And, you know, he was kind of saying, if you can't live on bread and water, you don't deserve to live. So in fact, that's what he said. And so this was upsetting, you know, some of the workers, churches are starting to feel maybe a consequence of this sort of alienation from workers. Okay. And so part of what is happening in the background here is you have the creation of a kind of almost a competing movement, which is socialism, which I had never thought of it before I started preparing this lecture. I've never thought about socialism as in competition with churches, right? But in a lot of ways they were, in that people were coming to churches for, you know, some of their sort of, you know, life meaning, coming to socialism for some of those same reasons. And the two really ended up kind of seeing themselves as potentially in competition with one another. And that's part of what's happening here. And so you have something during this period that's called the radical historical Jesus. This is something you guys might be familiar with from other speakers or other things you've heard about, but people are starting in the mid-19th century to do real historical research on biblical events, right? And particularly sort of the life of Christ. So you're getting a lot of interest in the historical Jesus, sort of placing Jesus in his historical context. And that is making a more political Jesus, right, emerge. You know, a Jesus that fits in relationship to the Roman Empire in a more obvious way. So what happens is that people on the far left, the labor left, the far labor left, and the throughout the spectrum of labor, are creating this sort of radical historical Jesus. And to quote one historian named David Burns, he says, "Free thinkers, socialists, and anarchists found a wealth of material in the Bible they could use to present Jesus with a rad as a radical bent on overthrowing the prevailing order. And in the process of marshaling this evidence, they contested the authority of the clergy and theologians to determine the parameters of religion." So what you have is a sort of much more fully developed competing image of Christ as a sort of left political radical, right? Which is being now circulated through labor newspapers. And labor now is becoming a very popular, labor newspapers are becoming very popular, labor speakers are becoming very popular. They have a podium, they have a way of circulating their ideas, and they're circulating a very radical idea of Christ pretty broadly. And so I just have a couple of examples here that I just gathered for this lecture so you can get a sense of what was going on here. This guy is anybody recognize him? This is Albert Parsons, who was a one of the guys who ended up being executed after the Haymarket Massacre. And so he was a socialist who was accused of being connected to the Haymarket incident, where somebody threw a bomb into a crowd or into police who were coming to suppress a socialist rally. And I think seven police were killed. And so they ended up executing five of the people that they had organized the rally. They knew that they hadn't thrown the bomb, but they thought they were, behind the bomb. And he was one of them. And this is him. So he was a very prominent Chicago labor leader. With all due regard, the very reverend gentleman, we must accuse him of that sin which Christ spoke of when he denounced the hypocrites of his day for trying to serve both God and mammon. For are not the wealthy classes of today the money changers in the temple? This Reverend Frado, however, claims the labor is worthy of his hire, but upholds a system which withholds from him the private ownership of capital. Or this guy, Reverend Sam Jones, who's a Southern traveling preacher, he's in the late 19th century. Once being a Christian was similar to being a socialist. It was being an antagonist to the respectable ones. Or you have Coxey's Army. I don't know, my mom always used to talk about Coxey's Army a lot. She would be like, "You guys are as hungry as Coxey's Army." I don't know if you guys, do you guys know what Coxey's Army? Oh, that was just her, apparently. But, huh? I don't know why she, I just assumed it was something that like everybody who was like, at least 20, 20 years older than me would know. But Coxey's Army was in 1894, a big group of hundreds of people. There was a recession in the 1890s, and a big group of hundreds of people marched from Massillon, Ohio to Washington, D.C. to demand food, demand like a social welfare system. And then also, but it wasn't just them, there was like 10 other armies that came and converged with them, and they did things like take over train cars, and they would come through like every city, and they actually came through Allegheny. And they stopped there overnight, and like the mayor of Allegheny, came out and gave them dinner that night or something, So it was like this social movement to demand a social system. And they believed that they were somehow in the spirit of Christ. Like they actually had a weird religion. but they kind of believed that they were, and they kind of said that they were the kind of manifestation of Christ today. But they meant in a kind of a stranger way. But they were very much in a Christian tradition and demanding a sort of like pro-worker social structure. Really interesting group, actually. They ended up, you know, being violently crushed, as you can imagine, but it was a really big deal at the time. Let's see. And then you have Eugene Debs, 1895. You know, he's going to be a perpetual presidential candidate on the left, a sort of pro-worker presidential candidate. He comes out of unionization tradition. He's the head of a railroad union. And he says, you know, where does the church stand in reference to labor? And the people that he's talking to, you know, say, against it, against it. Debs declares that they had seen the money, power enter the church, touch the robed priest at the altar, blotch his soul, freeze his heart, make him a traitor to his consecrated vows, or if true to his conviction, ideas, and ideals, to suffer the penalty of ostracism, to be blacklisted, and to seek in vain for a sanctuary in which to expound Christ's doctrine on the brotherhood of man. So you're getting like a real concerted left attack coming from a whole bunch of different directions, from the south, from the north, you know, from but largely from a sort of labor, you know, the poor, socialist direction. But it's going up to this guy who's a very serious presidential candidate. And I thought I'd stop this little list of examples of this with the most radical, which is from IWW newspaper. The IWW was like the most radical of the labor unions, the Wobblies. And they're going to be very violently suppressed at the end of World War I. But they are, this is from their newspaper, just kind of saying, I want to Jesus Christ, you know. So they're kind of, so it's kind of like the, but it's kind of a message that labor is getting out there that they want to say that the problem with modern Christianity is that it's like insufficiently Christian, right? Okay. And there were some reasons for this, the perception on the part of labor that the churches were not necessarily on their side. So you have even after 1877, you know, right after 1877, as I mentioned, a lot of the churches don't really know what to do, and a lot of them express sympathy for labor. But they also feel that it's necessary to keep order. And so some of them, so for instance, there is the Catholic, German Catholic newspaper in Chicago in 1877 says, you know, they think things were unfair. For what reason did presidents and directors need such fabulous salaries as they have? You know, how come it's, you know, workers don't get paid better? But then they also say in the very same column, we are not friends of strikes. We don't intend to lessen the atrocities that the strikes so often turn into during their demonstrations. So they say laborers, you know, we're sympathetic to them, but we don't believe in the tactic of strikes. But then you have other ministers after 1877 who are like, one minister in Chicago is like, trust in God and keep your powder dry. They should have been put down, whatever the cost. The soldiers, the police, and the militia, all the forces were but mediums for the translation of God's will. So, what's happening is, and I have a whole bunch of examples here that I'm actually going to pass through. But what happens is, after, with these kind of responses to the, you know, these kind of some laborers take this as sort of an unhelpful responses to their efforts to get better pay, their strikes. Workers start, you know, embracing this kind of negative attitudes towards the mainstream churches and start, in many cases, not going to the churches. And this starts to become talked about within church circles, so that churches often now are talking about the problem of losing the workers, and they have conferences, and they have, they send out surveys. They're like, well, why won't workers come to our church? Like, what's happening here? And they're so in some cases, what they're doing, there's a religious magazine, it's called The Interior, and it's saying, well, and the quote is, how snake-like, cold, and venomous is the spirit which crawls among the working men, lifts up its head in the shops and homes and club rooms, and hisses in their ears. The church is the ally of the capitalist and the oppressor. The Bible is the rich man's book. And so they're saying, these the, our congregants are being lured away by these kind of false impressions about what the church is standing for. But then others are kind of saying, well, we do have to do something to win back these workers, and maybe they have a bit of a point, or we certainly have to address the fact that this is a problem for us. And so you have a bunch of different ways that churches attempt to address this. And this guy is not a social gospel guy. I don't know if people have heard of Dwight Lyman Moody, but or the Moody Bible Institute is still in Chicago, is still his, is his legacy. He was one of the most powerful preachers of the 19th century. And he was actually the father of fundamentalism. I mean, you often would think of him as the father of religious fundamentalism, which we're not going to talk about today, really, but it's going to emerge at the same time as the social gospel, as a sort of alternative to the social gospel, right? But he's a very powerful preacher. And actually, Francis Willard, one of my favorite reformers, ends up traveling with him. And, so it was an interesting time. But he says here, I'm not speaking disparagingly of the different churches and missions now attempting to reach this class, the laborers, but anyone with their eyes open can't fail to see that the masses are not reached, right? So he's like, I don't know what we have to do. And he's going to have his own direction. He sets up the Moody Bible Institute specifically as a Bible institute to train ministers for workers, right? To train a certain kind of minister that are able to talk to workers. So he's going off in his own direction, but he's identifying what the problem is. And so you can see churches start to nudge a little and criticize, for instance, the greed of, capitalists or owners. The grievances urged by the strikers are real and serious, as one minister acknowledges. The rights of the employee in the eager rush of competition are much too often treated as if they have no existence. Or the Northwestern Christian Advocate says, the railways have not done justice to the workmen, whatever may be the present condition of the railways treasury. So you have a lot of praising of labor, a lot of denunciations of monopolies, denunciations of the accumulation of wealth. And you have some efforts to say, well, maybe there's some things we could do practically within our churches to try to bring workers back in. And one thing that starts to happen is a tendency to finally abolish pew rents, which we talked about a couple of talks ago, that people are having to pay a certain amount for where they sat in the church. The more you paid, the closer to the minister you could sit. Though nobody wanted to be in the first couple rows, so actually those were cheaper. It's actually really funny if you're a churchgoer. So there's a move to abolish church rents, and there's actually like really intentional efforts to do things like de-emphasize the social positioning within church, like encourage people not to wear their most expensive clothes and have that be the place where you're showing off your wealth. You know, that, you know, a kind of criticism of people who are showing up in fine carriages and things like that. So this starts to happen. So then you have, after 1877, you have many other, you know, labor crises. It's just a whole slew of labor crises through the late 19th and early 20th century. There's the, we talked about the Haymarket incident, but there's also the Pullman strike. The Haymarket incident is in 1886. And then you have the Pullman strike in 1894. And you just basically have thousands of labor strikes every year in the United States. And the churches are continuing to feel threatened by it. They have whole conferences that take surveys about how to respond to this. After the Pullman strike, the Reverend Engelbert Ogle at the Pullman Presbyterian Church fiercely defends George Pullman, right? Pullman is a city created by the owner of the Pullman Company, George Pullman. And so Reverend Ogle is basically working for the owner, George Pullman. And he says, unquote, "There's a maxim that half a loaf is better than no bread. In my judgment, the employees were getting two-thirds of a loaf," right? This is printed in the newspaper as chided by a pastor. Within a few months, there's a great book about this by an author I really admire named Heath Carter. And he said that this guy's church had lost 20% of its congregants within a few months of that. But then he was actually able to look at the church membership rolls and figure out who did he lose, who actually left. And he was able to show that it was the workers, you know, and their families who then withdrew from the church in those years, you know, or in those months after he was unsympathetic to their strike, which also had been violently suppressed by the military. So in 1899, there is a survey. The Workingmen's Alienation from the Church is the title of this survey. Workingmen felt that the church was against working men, but that Christ was on their side. "Most of the ministers are muzzled by their masters," said one person they were surveying, "and dare not preach the gospel of the carpenter of Nazareth." Advice from the surveyed people about what to do about this problem of the alienation of workers, somebody said, "Apply the Sermon on the Mount. Preach Christ, not theology. Let the pastor have a personal relationship with the needs of labor. Be our champion." There was a group called the Congregational Club, which invited a representative of labor to come and speak to them about why workers were not in their churches. And they invited this guy whose last name was O'Brien, and I'm sorry, I don't have his first name, but they invited this guy whose name is O'Brien. O'Brien rattled off a list of reasons why laborers found themselves increasingly estranged. In the first place, low wages prevented them from keeping up with the fashions of the church-going crowd. Additionally, they were tired of hearing about how their poverty stemmed from abusing alcohol. As O'Brien went on, it became clear that his view, wage earners' alienation, sprung more from social than doctrinal roots. He referenced a recent gathering where workers had cheered the name of Jesus but hissed at the very mention of the church, and recounted at length the testimony of a clerk he had interviewed, who wrote, "When I go to church, I see in the front pew a man who snatched the bed from under a widow, and another pew a man whose real estate is used for immoral purposes." He means a prostitution house. "If the church bore any resemblance to Jesus, I would be a churchgoer, but it does not." Building on the last point, O'Brien jested that local churches should post the Ten Commandments in their sanctuaries. so that their members might familiarize themselves with them. But what ends up happening out of this, which is why I like this anecdote so much, is that O'Brien then, after this like weird meeting with the Congregationalists, he goes on to found his own church. It's a workers' church called the Modern Church, and it's actually within a labor union. So the labor union pays for the minister's salary, and nobody has to give contributions at the church. And this actually, he's not the only one who does this. That actually becomes a bit of a movement in the 1890s, that unions, not everywhere, but it happens, say, many times. Unions actually set up their own churches within unions for workers.
Chicago.
This is in Chicago.
And most of what you're talking about is Midwestern and Northeast urban areas.
Yes. That's right. That's exactly right. Be very different. Like the things are gonna, this most of this doesn't apply very well in the South, but I think it's very similar to Pittsburgh. I think we would probably have been. I don't know if we had a church like this, but I wouldn't be surprised if we did. No weekly connection, no auctioning of pews, and no set creed. And so it was like a non-denominational church, right? No, but from an earlier time. Okay. Which brings us to how the mainstream churches respond to this attack. This book, which I've really been drawing very heavily on Heath Carter's book, which is called Union Made, a really, really good book, and I have it on a slide at the end. Heath Carter is a theology professor. He might be in the history department. I kind of think he's in the theology department at Princeton. Wrote a really good book about like the church and unions, which is what I'm really drawing on here, came out a few years ago. But basically, the church is going to respond to this problem by launching into the social gospel, right? And you have an early version of this with Washington Gladden. And I wanted to give you a sense of like what the social gospel does with the problem of workers here. So this is a Washington Gladden, is one of his, and this is he's kind of the grandfather of the social gospel movement, and that it doesn't really fully get going until the early 20th century. He's writing in the 1870s. This is his book, Applied Christianity. And here's just the table of contents, so you can see how he's really actually getting into a lot of social questions. But this is also the same period when churches are, a lot of churches are starting religious universities right at this time. A lot of churches are, the sociology movement and, or the kind of discipline of sociology and the discipline of social work are both starting at this time, and they're very largely populated by Protestant Christian, very religious Protestant Christians, right? So they're kind of like Protestant Christians are like flooding into trying to analyze what the social problems are that are causing the tensions largely between labor and capital. So, like, the best young Protestant minds are kind of, trying to solve the problem of, this kind of class tension. And this is a bit of a part of an early version of it, Washington Glenn's Applied Christianity, which is very widely read, very widely distributed. And so here he's talking about, is labor a commodity, right? And his answer is like, yes, but you have to look at it as a special kind of commodity. You're required to consider the life of the laborer, he says. The employer is bound to consider the effects of the employment which he furnishes and the reward which he gives for those services on the lives of those he employs. The health, morality, and happiness of people he employs are affected by the work they're doing. He's bound to see to it that, he's allowing them like a good life that doesn't lay too many temptations in their path. So you start getting this very serious thinking of the problem and how to solve it. You have people like George Washington would be another minister who has a book comes out kind of right at the very beginning of the high social gospel period called What to Do and How to Do It, the Bible and Socialism. And he actually is a minister, and then he becomes a labor leader. But he's like, I'm a labor leader, but I'm a minister as a labor leader, right? So, and then he writes this. His mom is actually really sad that he stops being a minister, and he writes about how he explained to her that in being a labor leader, he is being a minister. But all of his like sections in here, the poor and their oppressors, the poor and their oppressors continued. Is it working? Okay. You also have the, I was trying to find like specific thing that the Presbyterians were doing. And the Presbyterians, what I was able to come up with was in 1807, the Presbyterian Church, as part of this, sets up its own Presbyterian Department of Church and Labor, which you can actually read a really interesting document you can find online. In 1807, they say socialism must be reckoned with by the church. There are today nearly 9 million socialist voters in the world. In our own country, the gain by this party during the 4 years preceding the late presidential election was sevenfold. The increase continues. The socialists will elect a president. Whatever one may think of the economic value of socialism, and that would have been Eugene V. Debs would have been that president. Whatever you think of the economic value of socialism or the probability of its success, the fact remains, it's become to thousands of working men a substitute for the church. Already in several of our American cities, socialist Sunday schools and preaching services are being held, conducted in some instances by deposed or discontented ministers and priests. They have adopted the vocabulary of the church. They're insisting Christ was a socialist and that they more nearly represent the teaching of Jesus Christ than does Christianity, so-called. And what the Presbyterian Committee does is it fosters relationships with the labor unions that it likes the most, right? So, like the ones who are more moderate, they like trade unions best. They don't like, for instance, like the IWW, they wouldn't like, but like a trade union they'd like. Yes.
I wonder if there's anything, as you read that, I
Yes.
see a lot of they language
Yes.
where the Presbyterian Church is us and the labor people are they,
Yes.
those people.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if there's anything to the notion that the Presbyterian Church in this era, and I'm thinking maybe particularly of Pittsburgh, was sort of the church of the capitalists, whereas the Catholic Church was more the church of the workers.
That's definitely that was definitely something that was frequently perceived, right? And it's certainly I don't know what the numbers are, but it's almost sure certainly it's true that the immigrants coming in were largely from Catholic areas. So the poorest people coming in would have very largely been Catholic. And it's probably also true that capitalists, people who had, accumulated money, might have been more represented in the Presbyterian churches than others. Yeah, so I think that is true. But the Catholics are often having, and Heath Carter talks about this, the Catholics are having a similar problem, actually, as, not being seen as sufficiently supportive of workers in their churches. The Catholic Church never supports strikes, or officially doctrinally, it's opposed to strikes, and it's opposed to socialism, doctrinally. And so they're having much the same struggle, but often seen as, not as alienated from workers as, yes.
Well, they probably need the money that
Yes.
to run the church.
Yes. Yes, that's right. They need the money of the capitalists to run the church. This is certainly the case. And minister salaries, things like that. This is the period of the building of the churches, right? I don't know when this church was built. When was this church built?
Those four.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I should be able to pick that up. But like a lot of institutional churches, right, are being built right in this period. They're super expensive, right? Somebody's paying for them, and so that's gonna make a big difference, right? But basically, what's happening now is that what they do is they form relationships to the unions. They send like delegates. The Presbyterians will like send delegates to workers' meetings. They'll have like special meetings with labor leaders to try to like find commonalities and things like that. Sometimes the labor unions will name one of them as like an official minister of this labor union or something like that. So they're attempting in pretty formal ways to reach out to the more mainstream labor unions in order to try to solve this problem, but they are very intentional about it. You also have, most importantly, some of these new theologians of the social gospel movement. The most important of these is Walter Rauschenbusch, who I've talked about in some previous lectures. Walter Rauschenbusch. He writes several books which are become very popular. This is Prayers for the Social Awakening, A Theology for the Social Gospel, and Christianity and the Social Crisis, and where he's trying to work through what are the obligations of the Christian church to the worker. And yes.
Were these books in not radical, but confrontational to the existing church?
Yes. Yeah, but it's like a critique within the church. Rauschenbusch was a respected person, like within the Baptist Church, which was his church. But he was also a controversial figure. Yeah, no, I think that's right. So he says, nations do not die by wealth, but by injustice. And this is from Christianity and the Social Crisis. The forward impetus comes through some great historical opportunity which stimulates production of wealth, breaks up the caked and rigid order of the past, sets free the energies of new classes, calls creative leaders to the front, quickens the intellectual life, intensifies sense of duty and individual devotion, commonwealth, awakens the strong individuals in strong, large ambition of patriotic service. Progress slackens, and this is his negative. Progress in a nation slackens when a single class appropriates the social results of the common labor, fortifies its evil rights by unfair laws, throttles the masses, by political centralization and suppression, and consumes in luxury what it has taken in covetousness. Then there's a gradual loss of productive energy, an increasing bitterness and distrust, a waning sense of duty and devotion to country, a paralysis of the moral springs of noble action. Men no longer love the commonwealth because it does not stand for the common wealth. Force has to supply the cohesive power which love fails to furnish, right? Talking about the military suppression of the strikes. So part of what happens also is that the social gospel develops a theology which, you know, squarely confronts the tensions at the center of the conflict between labor and capital, and, you know, think about it in terms of its theological implications. So basically, the social gospel movement, which had many other parts, you know, its relationship to labor was only one part of it. But I would say that actually the whole social gospel largely emerged as an effort of the Christian church to resolve the crisis that they were seeing of losing the workers.
Big deal with this outside the church.
It was a really big deal because the social gospel movement was central to the foundation of social work, right? The foundation, like all social workers, right? You know, the foundation of sociology, right? If it hadn't been for the social gospel movement, you wouldn't have had, I mean, at least not in the form that they took, the emergence of like those disciplines. You know, I mean, it was actually like in 1807, there's this big thing called the Pittsburgh Survey, where they come in and they basically just like send in all sorts of scholars who like figure out like, how are working people doing in Pittsburgh? You know, how does, you know, what do people eat? Where do they live? You know, do an amazing, it's just like an enormously interesting resource, like multiple volumes about like working, the life of working people in Pittsburgh in 1807. But all of this is very much a Christian. It's the Christians who are driving the universities, the growth of the universities, and that's like around universities claim that they can solve these social problems, right? So I actually think it's a really, really big deal because it's actually kind of, I think it's driving the rise of institutions like, you know, University of Chicago, right? You know, Johns Hopkins, right? You know, things like that. But also a lot of new Christian colleges are actually really indebted to this effort of Christians to get their head around how to deal with this class conflict.
It goes on with it.
Yeah. And that's, I am out here. I actually did this because there was like a couple times ago, I finished the lecture. It was like, is this lecture over? And I was like, so. So you guys had questions during, but does anyone have a question now?
So was where does the Salvation Army fit into this movement?
Well, Salvation Army comes from England. So it's imported here, right? And it's imported here. I'm not going to be able to tell you exactly when. I want to say it's like the late 19th century is when it's imported here. I believe that that's true. But like, say, I'm going to put that in the same category as the Salvation Army, the YMCA and YWCA, right? Those things are actually, you know, crucial kind of almost like, I want to call them like, you know, organized Christian social institutions, you know, which become national and sort of crucial. I think the Salvation Army is certainly not social gospel. The Salvation Army from its beginning was more on the Dwight Lyman Moody side of things, right? And you're going to have the fundamentalists coming out of the early 20th century. And their thing is, our job is Christianity. Our job is not like feeding people, right? Our job is not setting up bowling alleys. Our job is not whatever. Our job is, introducing people to the living gospel, right? And the Salvation Army is really on that side of things, right? In that their goal is not to solve social problems, right? Their goal is to get you in the door so that they can give you the gospel. So I'm going to put them not, they're not part of the social gospel movement, but part of an interesting part of the fundamentalist movement. The YMCA and YWCA are much more closely affiliated with the social gospel.
Are any of the established religions today known as being more pro-labor?
I am gonna run out of expertise on that. I'm not gonna be able to tell you. I do think, I think that part of the appeal of kind of new evangelical churches, I think, is that they felt more welcoming. People coming in from workers, workers felt more welcome, perhaps, in some of the non-denominational evangelical churches, right? And I think that's part of the crisis that ended up biting the mainstream churches was that perhaps it's the case that workers went into those evangelical churches rather than that's precisely who was lost in the evangelical churches, maybe, or in the mainstream Protestant churches. That would be my guess. Anyway, people may have probably thought more about it than I have. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cool, I appreciate your lectures.
Oh, yeah, well, hope you appreciate it. I definitely enjoyed writing them a lot.